fears you have to let go, accepting that there's lots of things you don't know. You're feeling scared, it's irrational, but oh no, there's a tiny little face at the window. There's a tiny little face at the window. Look again and it's gone now, but uh-oh, there's that sound again that cannot be ignored. A tiny hand is coming underneath the door. A tiny hand is coming underneath the door. Who are you, what you want, and what you come here for? Then a terrified, tormented voice cried out, I'm your neighbor's kid and mama's locked me out. And I said, childhood fears, you have to let go, accepting that there's lots of things you don't know. You're feeling scared and it's rational to do so. Please get the fuck away from my window.
Lovely.
That's that one.
Who did it?
It's just pacing out. I felt like I was just doing it too quickly.
What, life?
Yeah. In a way.
Got through slightly too many years last weekend. When I went out, sort of in my late 20s, by Sunday night, I was 40.
I mean, it sounds abstract and absurd. Yeah. That's how I felt I was living my weekends.
Yeah. Wake up at a family dinner.
Wake up for family dinner and it's your children.
Yeah.
Father, pass the ketchup. Who are you?
I'm your daughter.
We're all your daughter now.
That has happened to me.
Yeah, kind of, right? I date my career by your children.
Yeah, look, so many people do because everyone remembers. People remember my children being born because obviously they're triplets, so that's a shocking thing to hear. That someone you know is having triplets, so everybody remembers that thing. Whereas everyone other comic we know who has children, they had a child, and then a year or two later they had another one, and after that everyone's lost interest anyway. So it's like, how many, people say to them, "How many kids you got?" "Oh, I've got four now." I'm older. You know, the youngest one's this and that. So no one can remember when they first heard about that comic having children, but everyone remembers the three that came on the same morning, and therefore it depresses people every time anyone ever asks me. Because we see each other so infrequently on the circuit, someone will say, "Oh, how are the triplets you've got?" And I say, "Yeah, how old are they?" And I'll say, "They've just turned 12. And people always look really sad because they cannot believe 12 years has gone by since they heard of these little babies appearing.
How was it when you found out it was going to be triplets as well?
It was. I was really excited about it because my wife and I, we were. We weren't finding it particularly easy to get pregnant, and there was some medical assistance involved. But two eggs became three children, and so I was really. For me, it was like we've won the lottery here. We've paid $5,000 and got three kids. Good value. Good value. if you don't think it through. Yeah.
I get excited when I get a multi-yoga egg, so I can't imagine the excitement you must have had as well from that moment.
What is a multi-yoga egg?
When you crack an egg open, you've got multi-yolks.
Oh, I thought you said yoga.
No, I said yoga. Oh. Not yoga owner.
I have to say, if I cracked an egg open, there was yoga involved.
Or Yoko. Tiny Yoko comes out.
Yeah,
she only lives in eggs.
Disturbing.
So we started the podcast obviously with one of your songs. Did you start doing stand up with your music to begin with, or did
this is a relatively recent thing because I started doing stand up in. It's shocking. We're talking about time passing. 93 was when I did my first stand up, and I very rarely did any music in my act. It was straight stand up. Occasionally, I would do an amusing rap. I've been known to do a couple of raps. David might remember some of those over the years. But there was never, you know, sometimes I had a backing track. I used to do a parody of a Beatle, of Beetle Bum by Blur, and I changed the lyrics in an amusing way. That was many years ago. And but mostly there's no music in my act, it's just stand up. But about 2 years ago, I bought a guitar while I was in Manchester gigging for the weekend, just for my own amusement. I bought this cute little guitar and I started sitting in my hotel room writing songs for my own amusement. And because I'd started doing The Cutting Edge at the Comedy Store, which is the kind of topical weekly show at the Comedy Store, I realised that there was a possibility of doing a bit of music in that, because every week they have a little section and one of the team does some music. So I rocked up with my guitar 1 week and said, I've written a couple of little songs and they liked them. And I started being one of the regular members doing the music on The Cutting Edge. And bit by bit, I wrote more songs. And in fact, I just suddenly had this prolific period of comedy songwriting. And with no intention of putting them in the act, they just sort of crept in. And then every now and then I do it at a show, but I rarely do it unless I'm convinced that they have a sound techie there who can make it sound good. And I tend to use this foot stomp box as well, which is sounds fantastic when it's through a good PA. Just a little, it's actually made out of an ice hockey puck, but you stomp on it and they take all the treble and middle off it and it just sounds like a bass drum.
Oh wow.
And that along with the little acoustic plugged in makes a convincing kind of noise. So yeah, that's it. My plan is for it not to ever be a thing that I can't go and do a gig without. Right, you know, I don't want to be somebody who has to have the guitar. I just think it's a nice thing to do occasionally.
Yeah, you don't want to be a musical comedian.
I've not got any snobby issues with musical comedians. I think a lot of them are great. Mm. And if that's your thing, brilliant. Dedicate yourself to it and everything. But I just see myself as a stand-up who sometimes does some music rather than a musical comedy.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that you sit in your hotel room and it's, you did it for your own therapeutic pain. There is something beautifully sort of meditative and therapeutic about writing music that there really isn't about writing jokes.
Yeah.
I write jokes in a fever. I've had an idea and I need to get it out of me. Yes. Let's formulate it before it. Literally, I'm trying to stick lightning in a bottle. There's nothing therapeutic about that.
And usually the idea is so it's often intangible, isn't it? That a bit of stand-up idea, you kind of feel it in your head that there's a gag in this. This is a funny idea. This is a funny topic. And I think I've got a route for it. And it can be so frustrating to find that actually it's nowhere near as funny as you thought it was, or that you can't engineer a way of making that plus that amusing. Whereas sitting with a little guitar on your lap and playing three chords and making some words rhyme, it's quite satisfying.
When you have a new bit, do you give it a couple of run-outs before you make your mind up about it?
Yeah.
You'll let it, if it doesn't go anywhere, a couple of times, don't give up.
Often far too many times before I realise it's not good at all, you know? Because sometimes you think, oh, this will just get better if I just keep saying it. And sometimes it does, but sometimes it's the 27th outing for that idea, and you're looking at yet another audience going, why did he say that? Yeah. You know, and you're like, because I think it's going to get funny.
Yeah.
And when they never agree, you have to go.
Eventually, you have to go. Maybe it won't.
You guys are right about that. Uh-huh. That's not good.
I think it's good. I was talking to a comic who's done a lot of TV, and he was basically, it's no compensation for not having done TV, but he was sort of being envious that I was bringing back bits that I'd done a long time ago, moved them around, added sort of like a couple of years of experience of stand-up and made what used to be a rather mediocre routine, but it was the same beginning, middle and end.
Yeah.
But I was better at doing it now. And he was like, but I've made all my mistakes on television, so I can't go back and take that routine and reboot it, because it's out there in that form, and I just have to forget about it.
I really feel sorry for whoever this is.
Yeah. We're
so lucky
to not be racist.
We can do our staff in little clubs for £100 over and over again. And that poor guy has to, just do it once for like £15,000? I don't know how he sleeps at night.
Not well. Beds made of money aren't as comfortable as you think.
I think what this person was trying is that was, you know, that it's ruled that, you know, routines, they can be organically grow for ages.
Yeah.
And live, and you take bits off and put them back on again, and they have a lot longer lifespan than the oft quoted turnover an hour's material a year.
Definitely
business model that everybody quotes. I think
sometimes I've had bits that have just every now and then, as I'm doing the bit, I think of another bit that could fit the bit, and yeah, the bit just gets longer. And lots of my, I don't want to say bit again. No. Lots of my routines.
Let's
are,
talk more about your bits.
My bits get longer and longer.
Over time.
Or lower and lower. I think that's, no, let's not go there.
But
yes,
work.
You can hear it actually in a lot of my routines. You can hear the initial idea that probably ended there, and then you can sort of hear these extensions which just sound like, oh, hang on, I just thought that, if that's funny, then maybe this is funny, and then and that's actually how I write a lot of my stuff.
Sure.
The initial bit's there, and all the other laughs, the six laughs after that, were probably live gig ad libs that I just had the foresight to write down and remember.
You are a great ad libber, as a comic that isn't thought of, you know, because you're very sort of like, you've got bits that are well written that are good routines.
Mm.
But I've seen you go like Leeds, can't remember whether it was Jonglers or Highlights at the time, but I remember you going off for almost the whole set about the condiments hordle that was on the table of everybody's table, so they had the ketchup and the mayonnaise and everything for their burgers and chips. And you went off on the idea that it was this girl's handbag.
When I picked it up, like, why have you brought this out?
Yeah, exactly. And it was a beautiful bit of comedy, but I assume that only ever lived once, and it's
I don't even remember
gone.
It.
Oh, well, I'll write that. It down and give it to you.
Thank you. There would have been probably a reason why I wanted to not do my act.
Right.
Sometimes it's, you know, I'm literally just sick of my act, and I think, God, it'd be really nice if I could get some laughs saying any other words than those words in that order. And sometimes just starting somewhere else can make your act feel better anyway.
Right.
And oftentimes it's just a holiday for the mind, isn't it? If you can just see, I'm going to start saying this and see what happens. And sometimes it's surprisingly good.
It's easy to do it on a Saturday night in front of 300 people in a Jonglers highlighty type thing. It's
what
one
was
thing.
I thinking?
But I admire it. Because I think there's something about the comics that sort of like, and I certainly suffer from this myself. Certainly on a Thursday night here, which I compete nearly every Thursday, I completely freewheel, and because I feel very safe here. This is my home club. You sometimes can be your worst enemy by not thinking, oh, this is a Saturday night in a big club, oh, I won't be like that. But actually, you know, you're at your funnest when you're feeling free.
Yeah.
And sometimes I now find myself at a sort of like unexpectedly bigger gig than normal. Oh, God, I suddenly feel nervous, having months of not being nervous. And trying to psychologically trick myself that it's a Thursday night at the backyard.
Yeah.
So that I go on with that complete let the chips lie where they fall type attitude. Because funny's not... I started, I think...
You
I
shouldn't waste... really bring your dinner on stage with you, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. I think I wasted a fair few years of my beginning of stand-up thinking that stand-up was something that you had to... I mean, obviously you have to work hard at it, but you can't work hard at it while you're doing it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I complete sense, because I think the really frustrating thing is if you have found a way to be relaxed on stage after years of whatever it is, you know, training yourself to do that, it's depressing to realise that you can't just magic that feeling up again... five
somewhere
nights
else.
A week, whenever you want, because it's it's intangible, isn't it? And it's hard to know why that night in Leeds I felt relaxed enough in front of 300 people to just start riffing about the, you know, condiments. I mean, I could have tried that the following night and people would be throwing them at me, you know. Do your jokes, you know. But sometimes there's something happening in the room, there's something about the people and the mood that they're in, and you pick up on that, and they pick up on the fact that you're very relaxed, and then this magical thing can happen. And and if you get a few laughs for an ad lib, you're encouraged to continue. And it's only when, you know, you slam the brakes on yourself, usually, don't you?
Yeah.
We all do, thinking, oh, I don't think they're going to go with that, so I'll go A, B, C tonight instead of starting in F. And it's frustrating when that's what you wanted to do and you didn't let yourself, you know. But you're right, you can't manufacture the feeling. The feeling has to come organically.
So one of the most important things in a comedian's skill set is reading a room. Surprisingly, not every single comedian has that, it seems. But do you think that's something that you developed over time as a comic, to read a room properly, or is it something you just had straight away that helped you develop your comedy around it?
I don't know. I think I started out emceeing a gig. So my very first standing on stage was at this venue in Aldershot that I used to run a comedy night on a Sunday once a month. And I booked comics that I was seeing up in Clapham. I used to go to a gig called The Cartoon at Clapham. So I was a comedy fan who wanted comedy in my hometown, and the Arts Centre said, why don't you book it? You sound like you know more than we do. So I, by accident, became a performer, because I would book three acts and that was the budget used up. And I would go up and introduce them all. And those introductions just got a bit longer and a bit longer as I got addicted to the whole being on stage thing. And so my whole shtick came out of, I don't really know what I'm doing, but this is fun, isn't it? Isn't it exciting to be here? And soon we'll have a comic on, you know. That. So I think I was a kind of in natural MC before I was a natural comic. So some of my style evolved out of that, I think. I think I was always willing to park material that I was planning to do and talk to the audience. And I always got quite a kick out of that, especially when it turned into funny, you know. If you get laughs as big as from your set through something that's happened in the room talking to a complete stranger, that's really exciting. So some comics don't like talking to the audience, and that's, I don't blame them, you know, because it's an unpredictable place to go, and some audiences are not great fun, you know. They've come out to be entertained because they're not very, sometimes, because they're not very entertaining people. So sometimes you throw it out to them and it's disastrous, because you're like, these people don't have anything to say. And those are the nights where it's really important that you've got bits, you know, because you can't conjure it up out of thin air.
Do you remember what your first bit was? Do you remember that moment where you went, this is a bit, I'm going to use this over and over again?
I think I started improvising about my childhood at those gigs. So at the time I was in my early 20s and I was talking about being 10. Which is funny, because at the time it seemed like so long ago, but actually, you know, now that I've been doing stand-up for 25 years or whatever, it's me talking about 10 years before as this hilariously long time ago. I mean, I've got bits of material I still do now that are older than that. But yeah, it was stuff about childhood, stuff about snorkel parkers, I seem to remember, and I used to do a bit about jumping off the swings in the park, you know, how you used to be able to swing really high and then leap off and see how far you could land. Did you ever play that game?
Yeah.
And about how I came down to the park one day and there was 15 feet away from the swing, there was just a wreath on the floor, and I thought, my mate Tim's finally broken my record, you know. So it's stuff like that. And I probably, you know, I probably ad-libbed that at the Trapdoor, which was the name of this club. It got a laugh, and I thought, well, that's it, that's a bit, and I wrote that down and then expanded on it. And so that's how the first stand-up I ever wrote happened. It was either improvised or bits from the month before that I'd expanded on. But I always had a month before I was next going to stand on stage. And that was the first year or two of my... So it was the slowest possible entrance into a thing. And it wasn't going to be my thing, you know. I was going to be, you know, one of the finest printers in Hampshire.
Printer.
Well, I stumbled in and out of lots of crappy jobs, but one of the last ones I did was printing and reprographics, and that was the job I finally went in to see my boss and said, I'm giving up. I'm handing in my notice to do this full time.
David Bowie's last day job before he went professional.
Printing?
Yeah.
I knew we had more in common than just my comedy and songwriting talent and these weird eyes.
He should have stayed in printing. That Bowie.
Yeah.
That is an interesting way to start off, because obviously you kind of warmed up into it, while most people just, you know, would just smack straight into a, you've got 5 minutes. So that's a really good way that you got to warm up. I suppose you were comfortable.
When I first did an open spot in London, I had this weird level of background experience, and some of the other open mics that I was at this gig with were literally stepping on the stage for the first couple of times ever, and they were terrified. I was still pretty nervous, but I'd done it probably 20 times by the time I did my first open spot, so I was just that little bit more confident with it. But there weren't many open mics, open spot nights in those days. I used to go to this place called The Bar in Willesden, and people like Paul Tonkinson was also there. It was a Monday night. Rudy Liquid I saw down there, and one or two other old names was just starting out in those days, and that was one of those places you were encouraged to go at 6 p.m. I think you had to go, arrive at 6, write your name in a book, and then just go and sit nervously in the corner with your notes, waiting for this little bar to fill up with ne'er-do-wells who goes out on a Monday night to watch amateur comics?
It is odd.
You know,
I remember when I started inheriting a gig in Deptford, of all places, and obviously no one would come to it. And I remember when anybody had a sort of a paddy that there was no audience, I'd be like, well, why would there be?
Yeah.
I have spent the last 2 hours flying at Deptford Bridge Station, but nevertheless.
It's amazing, though, that those open mic nights happen. And it's great that they do. I went to the first one that I've been to in many, many years a couple of months ago with a friend of mine who's on the open mic circuit. And it was a bit of a shock, because it was over in West London. I think it might have been a Sunday night. And I think he and I had been drinking all day. So that's why I went, because it seemed like a really good, fun idea.
Yeah.
And when we got there, I was a bit shocked to realise that this tiny little room above a pub, there was about 9 people in there, and only one of them wasn't on the bill. Yeah. Do you see what I mean? So there they were, just performing their little bits to each other, you know. But it's still valid, because you're still saying the words, and you are in public,
and those other 9 performers are still at that point 90% fan and 10% performers.
That's
so they are an audience.
Yeah.
There's one that I should go to far more often, because it's right on my doorstep, the Vine Pub in on Highgate West Hill, just come out from Kentish Town. There's a Tuesday night gig in there, run by a comedy company called TNT. And the reason why it works is it really has a community feel. It's just like all the new acts are so excited to be there. They're so supportive of each other. There is a sort of, you know, there is a club atmosphere of them being, look what I've come up with this week, until they feel that it's time for me to move on. I won Southampton Comedian of the Year, don't you know? And then they feel too big for that. But and then they move on. But then there'll be another 100 acts wanting to take their place anyway. So it's.
Oh, I guess for a lot of people, even if stand up isn't something you're planning to do as a career, so many people these days, I think, want to try it. Mm. You know, like people try Zumba and bungee jumping, and, you know, playing the banjo.
It's such a bad idea to just try it, because you can do 100. Somebody who has the potential to be good could still be horseshit for their first 100 gigs.
Yeah.
It's something that has to, even periods of time when it just sort of like isn't what I'm thinking about the most at the time, because I've had an acting job or something else is happening in my life or something. I just suddenly stopped being as good as I was the month before, because it is something that has to be all inclusive, doesn't it? I don't think it is something that, well, I tried it once, like bungee jumping.
Like one of those London experiential nights that everyone does now, like taxidermy, or the weirdest one I heard was the woman, she was like, oh yeah, I'm going for an evening of welding. Like, what? Yeah, me and my friends, we've all booked a night of where we do some welding, learn to weld. Like, you are going through some crisis here.
Wow.
Yeah. I hope it was on an oil rig.
No, it was just somewhere, some little warehouse in London. Bunch of middle-aged, middle-class women just getting together and doing some welding, like flash dance.
It would only make sense if they were thinking of maybe moving to China. Yeah. I don't think we weld things here anymore.
No, we're not welders. Not welders. We might be post-Brexit.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, do all our own welding again.
We're going to have to do everything. Maybe that's going to be the silver lining, the discovery of old crafts.
Yeah, like finding food in bins and things like that.
You just have to find a Frenchman's bin.
I think I've seen that experiential night. Find your own food.
I tell you what, check the skip round the back of the Polish shops, because I reckon that'll be full of out-of-date stuff just before they leave. Yeah. What's going to happen? I was thinking about that. So many of those shops sprung up, didn't they? That just sell Polish goods to the Polish people that are here. That's a lot of shops that are going to shut.
Well, unless things go tits up massively, I don't think people that have relocated are going home, are they?
I think they are.
Yeah.
They'd have to really push it. There'd be some uproar on that, because isn't the initial idea that they will try and keep people established here as long, you know, try and keep them here and find them a way to get citizenship if they don't and such, and then draw a line? I hope so.
I don't know. I know at least one German friend of mine who's been living here for a number of years, and he's got it's a very odd situation, because his son is British, so he's got a son, he's had here, mixed race boy. And he doesn't feel welcome anymore, you know. Wow. But his son's only ever known London.
Yeah.
So he's talking about going back.
To fuck off.
You're not my real dad. I am. But you're German. I will explain. But yeah, it's an odd situation, isn't it? Because he, you know, this boy's bilingual. He speaks German and English. He's only ever lived in England. He's visited Germany, but now his dad feels less welcome and is thinking about going back to live in Germany.
Wow.
So this boy might go with him, you know.
Just leaves him.
Well, it's complicated because him and the mum have split up, so he already lives in these two homes. But, I just think, well, who knows what the repercussions are going to be, but it's not going to be smooth.
Yeah. No.
Do you find yourself putting a lot of that into your act as well, about the current political climate?
A little bit. More so since I've been doing The Cutting Edge, because I didn't used to think of myself as a comic that could do topical or political, even though I'm reasonably aware. I just used to think, well, that stuff's not funny. I can't make that funny. Mm. I admire people who can make that stuff really funny, and I just didn't used to try. I used to keep my material outside of that, but The Cutting Edge has forced me to write stuff based on the news, and I find that I can see the funny side of some of it, even though it's quite bleak.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it, where it's gone so bleak that it's not as easy to make fun of politics at the moment.
No, it's very divisive. People are very divided, and the audience is just the same, you know. So sometimes you bring up Brexit stuff, as you know, I think we're all aware of. It depends where you are in the country. You know, you can safely have a few jibes about Brexit in London, usually. But you go to Kent and they're furious that you've even suggested that
it might not be a good thing.
That it might not be a great idea.
And, we talk about, do you find that, I mean, it's funny, I think we've all noticed a sort of in London, out of London thing with Brexit, but as a general rule, gigging abroad, have you done the Far East quite a bit, done Singapore or India or...?
Not for a long time, certainly not since Brexit. Where have I been? I mean, I've done gigs abroad in the last year or two, but not the Far East. I've done Dubai.
They don't care. But I didn't mean just about Brexit. I mean, in general, do you find you... I mean, obviously one has to adapt in every room to play the room, as Chris said earlier, you know. But do you find that...
different parts of the world? Do you have to do different things? Or do you...
Luckily...
Did you get the rap out more often in the Middle East? And by that, I mean your vocal rapping, not...
Yes, best not to get a rap out in the Middle East. Yeah. I don't think you'll be coming home. Do you know what? It rarely seems to matter because, A, quite often you're playing to, certainly in those kind of rooms, you're playing to expats anyway.
Right.
The only problem you have in those rooms is that they're not, the kind of expats you play to are usually kind of apolitical.
Right.
I don't care about anything, right. You know. So actually then you just revert to all your filth.
Right.
Because, you know, wanking is universal.
Yeah. It crosses the floor. But only when you...
Wow. Those were the days.
Do you worry about where you're filthy or not, or do you go through periods of time where you try to clean up your act or embrace it more?
Well, I do go through... I've always done a certain amount of slightly smutty stuff. I like to think that I have a intelligent take on the knob gag.
Yeah.
But essentially...
That's what I tell myself too.
Yeah, it's always made some of that stuff has always made me laugh. But now, I couch it in such a way that I'm talking about why is it the British find sex so funny and yet we're so embarrassed about it? Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of stuff about that, and then I still get the knob gay in at the end, whilst making it sound like I'm trying to be a little bit more intellectual. Sure. But I do go through periods of thinking, oh, I swear too much, or there's too much gynecological humour in this, and rest it for a bit, and then it always,
creeps back in.
Creeps back in. Some people, it fills up their act, doesn't it, David?
Yeah.
So you've done quite a bit of the television as well.
In the past,
you've done somewhat television.
Yeah.
Do you find that? Did you have to be as clean as you could be on there, or were they fine?
Yeah,
it was never mind the Buzzcocks, and they're a bit more.
Yeah,
pushed the boundaries.
I seem to remember they had this. They had some weird rules about you can say the F word. But I don't know if you swear on this podcast.
Oh yes.
you can say fuck, but you can only say it twice or something, or you know, some of them actually
each.
Have a rule. Like I think it might be per show. So
somebody else has said has fucked it up for everybody else by fucking twice.
If someone did that, that would be at least three other people who couldn't say fuck.
Yeah.
I think they used to genuinely say, you know, you can say that, but don't say this, and you know, there were some limits on it. So
like
some swearing allowed, but not loads of swearing.
Yeah.
You can only say cunt while you've got the cunch.
That's
surprisingly difficult sentence.
Yeah.
Did you find doing that your spontaneity kicked in, or did you find yourself a bit more prepared for doing
Well,
that?
Funny you should say that. I did Mock the Week three times, I think. Was it four? I was the warm-up guy for a whole season of Mock the Week, and that's how I got on the show. It was really by pure luck. There was no way they were out scouting, looking for the likes of me to get on the show. I was just in the studio every week doing the warm-up with the audience. And the first time one of the guests that was meant to be on realised that she was too pregnant to come on, and that she only realised that afternoon. So I rocked up to do the warm-up, and they said, oh, so-and-so isn't coming.
Wonderful,
I think it might have been...
surprised way that woman must live her life.
Yeah. Well, it was...
Every day's a treasure for her.
Oh, my God, this won't fit behind the desk. So I got offered, you know, do you want to go on the show? And I was absolutely delighted and went on the show. And that time I had the afternoon to prepare. I think they had called me, actually, at lunchtime and said, would you come in early if you want to be on the show? So I prepared some stuff. The next time that they knew the day before, so I got the whole day to prepare, like all the other people on it. But the third or fourth time, and I can't remember which it was, is the now infamous time of Frankie Boyle going to hospital, and he felt he was having heart palpitations, apparently, and off he went to A&E, and he was fine. But this was literally an hour or so before record time, and I had turned up to do the warm up again, and they said, "Would you go on instead of Frankie?" And I did, and I had no preparation at all. I hadn't seen any of the questions, none of it, which is how a lot of people probably assume the show is.
Yeah.
Everyone's just being amazingly witty about stuff they've just heard. And actually, well, I hope I haven't spoilt it for anyone, but some of them even have writers, I'll tell you that. I didn't know anything that was going to... And I really enjoyed it because there was nothing to stress about, because on some of the previous ones, I had 9 or 10 jokes per subject written on my pad, and I only got 2 of them out because... I don't know if you've noticed, but those guys can be quite competitive. Certainly they were 4 or 5 years ago. And so that was really frustrating, whereas this time I just winged it. And every time I thought of something funny to say about the photo or the caption or the thing, I just said it. And it was natural and really enjoyable, and that was probably the one that I enjoyed the most.
Mm. Do you think the show would be better
if I was back on it? Yes.
I do as well, but do you think it would be better if it was more spontaneous?
Well...
And maybe some of the questions had been prepared for, but some of them weren't, maybe.
It would certainly be better if the kind of people who... that format suits were doing that show.
Right.
But because, you know, not everybody is an improviser, and not everybody would enjoy that experience. And also, I think the record, it already takes about 2.5 hours. They probably need 4 hours for that. Mm. So they just hedge their bets by having everyone's a bit prepped, you know, and actually good comedy writers are writing good jokes for those comedy people to say, and the end product's probably... You know, pretty good, but I would have enjoyed it more if it was a level playing field and everyone was just being funny in the moment. Mm. That would have suited me better.
But you're right, I think we would be seeing a very different cast of people.
Maybe. Yeah.
Mm. And that said weekend that I was talking about in Leeds, you were then planning a tour. Is that something that you still... You're a club comic who loves the club, if I'm right in interpreting you, like,
yeah,
club environments.
I never thought that the comedy circuit was
them or us.
Yeah, and I also never thought that I'm going to do this until I can get there. Yeah. I thought this was a goal, you know. Mm. When I first started, to be a headline act in a comedy club full of people was an absolute dream.
Mm.
So... it would be great to tour, though. I mean, absolutely. The thing that a bit of TV exposure gives you is that enough people have heard of you to take a punt on a £25 ticket to come and see you at their local theatre or whatever those tickets cost. And that's a lovely thing to be able to do, and to write a couple of hours of comedy and tour that and then take a year off and write the next lot. That's a nice model, too, you know. There's no way I'd like to pretend I need to be on stage 5 nights a week in... all over the country, otherwise I wouldn't feel like I was achieving anything. Sure. It'd be great to have a bit of both. I think I'd love to stay doing some club gigs, but actually, you know, like most professional comics, I have to do a certain amount of gigs a month to feed my kids, pay the mortgage. So it's, you know, there's a bit more stress to filling your diary and looking at it. It's a business, it's a small business, and I often feel just like if I was running a little retail shop, you know, I'd be doing that thing of working out how much stock to take in, how much have I sold, what can I, you know, you have to run it quite seriously and sometimes sit on the phone and juggle things around and work out where you can get a double up and occasionally accept corporate type gigs that really sound like they're going to be really horrible, but you do them anyway, and sometimes they go well and sometimes less so, but you bring some money in for your kids, right? So, but the theatre tour thing is a joyful experience. And I've toured with Ed Byrne a few times as his support act. So I got a glimpse into that world of, 2,000 seats sold, big stage, follow spot, the anticipation of the audience and what you can do with that. Mm. And do you know what? It was just my club set on that stage. And it didn't need to be adapted. It was just felt bigger and more theatrical in that setting. Maybe I slowed it down a bit. But I loved it. So when I did that tour, I got a little, that was off the back of touring with Ed, actually. We went back to a few of the cities that I'd been with him, hoping that enough of those people would come back and see just me. And they wouldn't.
Did you?
No, it was okay, but you know, it was small.
There's a night here in the backyards, Brainwash, which is run by a double act, Ellis and Rose, and they are more of the sort of wacky, ironically sort of surreal type comedy that tends to be a bit too soft for a club night.
Mm.
But they do get some very good headliners, including of late, you know, obviously the king of the surrealists at the moment, Tony Law, but also Harry Hill's been down to do it. And the night Harry Hill was on, obviously sold out, 300 people, the room was packed, people hanging off the rafters. And the two that run it got the whole room to stand up and do a swear that they would come back for the Brainwash night, regardless of whether there was a TV name on or not.
Yeah.
And then I do solemnly swear that I will return regardless of TV celebrity status. And the next month they had 28 people in the
club.
Isn't
it amazing? Yeah. Well, I mean, that means people don't take the oath seriously.
Very,
enough,
no.
The Harry Hill oath. But, yeah, I mean, that's the world we live in. People absolutely respond to people they've seen on TV and assume that if you're not on TV, you just can't be anywhere near as good.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's a bit annoying.
Yes. It's not a bit annoying. It's colossally annoying.
But, you know, the people who regularly go to their local comedy club, regardless of who's on the bill, because they trust the promoter, they find out that actually there's loads of great comics out there that they've never heard of, but that promoter will bring them three or four brilliant acts every month or every bi-weekly or whatever it is, and they trust them. It's just the wider public, they won't do that.
Yeah, it's a mentality of the safe bet, isn't it? The industry kind of does do, to an extent, in all different areas where, you know, you'll get Instagram stars cast in movies because they have a big following.
Yeah.
People know them and people are aware of them, so it's just putting their money on all these safe bets.
Yeah.
And the audiences are doing that as well.
Yeah.
That's why you need a Dwayne Rock Johnson
sometimes. I don't think it is a safe bet. I think when you have three comics that have been picked by a booker, and that booker is worried that he has one of those three as a dud, and the evening won't be great, and then people won't come back next Saturday. You've actually had a fuck lot more thought into it. One, you're far more likely to, you know, like have three acts doing 20 minutes each than one act doing an hour. I wouldn't say the safe bet is genuinely three acts doing 20 minutes.
It's much less of a gamble, isn't
it? Yeah, and the fact that they've been picked only on their ability, not on their ticking sellability, although I'm sure it's only a matter of time before that dribbles down to the club level as it did in America, that basically that everyone's just there to see the headliner.
Yeah.
And the others are merely there as...
Which is why some of the best gigs in this country don't even talk about it in the form of a headliner.
No.
It'll be, you know, the Glees first, and the Comedy Stores. Yeah. It's like where all of these acts could be on in any order, and often they are, actually. Over the weekend, in the old days of Thursday, Fridays and Saturdays at some of those clubs, they would swap it all around because everyone was capable of going in every position. And as we know, headlining can be a crown of thorns, can't it? Because sometimes at some clubs, by the time you get on at 10:15, everyone's broken and they've seen enough comedy and it's all just turned the corner a bit. Yeah. So, I used to genuinely look forward to the day when I would be considered a headline act. And I've had some fantastic times going on at the end and all of that. But sometimes you watch the middle act and they're having a joyful time. And then there's that interval and you see people carrying a tray of shots back into the room. And you know, oh dear, this audience is broken. Well, and that's when you have to really earn your money.
When they used to be in Jongleurs, the paid half set. So you'd done a couple of open spots and they like were investing in you, but you weren't ready for a 20 yet. And I did one of these paid halves in Battersea. And I was so...
You say paid. When did you get paid?
Well, this is the old days of the real Jongleurs. The old Jongleurs. And I was so excited about it. And that excitement was completely extinguished by seeing a hen on a hen do, down a bottle of rosé in the interval before I went on.
Wow.
I mean, it was quite a thing to watch, but it did make me think that my routine about Richard Dawkins that I was so proud about might not be the well-selected.
That's what all women do before dates with you, is that right?
I was going
to
say...
Yeah, I need to say, she wasn't downing a bottle of rosé because she heard she had to sit through 10 minutes of David Whitney.
They walk in, they see you sat at the end of the bar, they make a beeline straight for the bar, bottle of rosé, please, down it. All right, let's do this. Go and join you.
And then you called off the wedding.
For the third time.
Oh, I hadn't worked it out till now. That's what I had seen her before when I proposed.
You know, that was when I first went to Jongleurs Battersea. You know that was their, you know, that was their first venue. That was their very first venue.
Yeah.
So I first went there in the 80s, and it was absolutely like super cool place to go. And I think I saw Vic and Bob get ignored off by the audience because they were too surreal. You know, the audience were at that time at that gig saw themselves as you know, comedy connoisseurs, I think, and they thought this was all a bit too silly and surreal, and they were the open spot, Vic and Bob. So that's how long ago that was. And you know, it was a really kind of high end cool venue. The only thing I didn't like at the time was there was a yuppie contingent who were buying you know, either bottles of champagne or big crates of, you know, big jugs of beer, and but treating it a little bit like a gentleman's club. But it was still kind of, it felt like comedy fans were going to this thing. And then many years later, when I was playing it, and Jongleurs had got to that kind of
corporate level,
well, that kind of Christmas party, you know, hen and stag, really dry. Some of the most unplayable gigs I ever did were in that room.
Really?
Yeah, around Christmas. Yeah, I mean, when it got bad, it got really bad in there. Just, you know,
still have those old rooms back in a heartbeat in comparison to the sort of the ones that we did a couple of times together in nightclubs. They're sort of they're sort of Oceana prisms.
Oh, they were terrible.
There'd be no care whatsoever of it, just put a mic at one end of the room and
it was like, we've got your money and it doesn't really matter what happens post 7:30 because we've got your money and you're probably going to carry on buying drinks, so the club's happy, and we, you know, and we don't have to pay the acts. It's a win-win.
I remember walking out with you, they all look the same inside, so I can't even remember which city we were in. I think it was Bristol.
When you say they all look the same inside, you are talking about the clubs.
The nightclubs. Not the audience members.
Because I don't remember that weekend.
It was odd because you have been holding ransom of the photos over me. All these nightclubs look the same inside. Mm-hmm. We were walking out, we both, I could do with a drink. And we were trying to think of somewhere in the vicinity that we could get a drink, because it was, you know, by the time the show was over, it was not sort of pub o'clock because the pubs would be shutting. And we were like, I can't think of anywhere. I just have to get back to that. As we were saying, can't think of anywhere, we were walking out of a bar that was open at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
But the atmosphere of those places was so horrible.
You didn't even want
to
be there.
We didn't. Yeah. Even the prospect of a free beer was not enough to keep us in this sticky purple and mirrored room.
Yeah, so some of the dressing rooms are shockingly unpleasant, aren't they, in some gigs. We don't have to tell any tales on, you know, in specific ways, but, you know, I've changed in some, I say changed, I don't usually change to take my coat off, but in some pretty grim, you know, places where you say, is there anywhere I can put my stuff? And they're like, well, you just put it by the chip fryer there. You're like,
walk into a room. How is every side, every edge, every platform in this room sticky? How is
and the floor and
the floor, the ceiling, the walls.
Sticky stages, they're the worst. You can actually hear
something really horrible. Something that completely changes the tempo of a joke. If there's a heartbeat of you being able to pull a foot off the stage, you really.
Yeah.
I'm right in thinking.
Yeah, definitely.
That, right?
Yeah.
You're quite genuinely not being quick on your feet.
Yeah, and I think the front row can hear it too.
It's like I'm a Celebrity challenges for comedians. It's like different things that will slow them down on my comedy. I want you to get up there and I want you to do some comedy, but the stage is made of glue.
You're wearing deep sea divers boots. So Christmas is coming up. You're packed with gigs up to Christmas. So you,
yes, I've got a few. I've got a few, I think, that fall into the category of Christmas show.
Yeah. Not as many as they used to be.
No, not
which is a double-edged sword. You don't have to do the horrible things, but you don't get as much money.
Yeah, yeah. I know what you mean. I mean, there were Christmases in the past where it looked amazing in your diary, and the income potential was fantastic. But also, you got to the end of the Christmas period and felt
like, broken.
Yeah, it's quite bleak, isn't it? Just entertaining. People or trying to entertain people who don't want... Yeah, I mean, why don't they learn? These people don't want to go and listen to somebody else talk.
They want to go paintballing.
Yeah.
They all just want a crack on Amanda from accounts.
You know, I genuinely think, I've often thought this, is why they don't do something like, you know, hire a club, a room like a comedy club, a room like this. Everybody comes in with their drinks, sits around all the little tables, just like it's a comedy club, and just hand the mic around the audience. Mm. Because they often think that they are the funniest people. Like, look, you don't need us.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we'll all take the equivalent of a fee just for setting it up. And here's the mic. See you later. You know, I think they probably quite enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Give them a little stage. Send them up. Yeah. They have the stage. That's what they want, isn't it?
Actually, that is probably what they want.
Yeah, it is what they want. That's why everyone wants to be that comic. You see it when... I see it here a lot as well. Audiences coming in, and obviously they're all getting ready, getting their drinks before they come in the back room, and you can hear them talking to each other, doing their best sets to each other. And it's that thing of the vibration of, oh, we're about to see something funny, or we've just seen something funny. And as they go through the show, between and for every interval, every gap, they're doing it more and more people are doing that. It's because they see it and they go, I want to do that. I want to get up there. I want to be... They want that spotlight. It's a good idea.
Once at Camden, whatever it was at the time, the thing that is in Dingwalls, whether it was at Highlights or whatever at the time, there was an audience member who was desperately chipping in, not in an aggressive, nasty heckler way, but he was desperate to be involved. And I was comparing, and I said, oh, hey, you seem to want to have a crack at this yourself. And he went, yeah, I've got a joke. And I thought, my first reaction was the worst thing in the world to give this guy any more oxygen than possible. And I thought, because his joke will be shit.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, come on then. Got him up, got him to tell the same, you know, gave him the mic. Obviously the joke died on his ass, and he was silent for the rest of the night.
Yeah. Yeah, he got a glimpse into what the jeopardy that is really always there. Because if you're watching a good comic and you've never done comedy, you could be forgiven for thinking that it's quite easy, because a good comic, it looks like he's just chatting to you. And I think that's what sometimes happens, is audiences, they just see somebody who appears to be completely relaxed, just shooting the breeze, really, and they're thinking, well, I do that at work. Yeah. So I could do that out there. And just, if everyone got just a glimpse of how quickly it can fail and what that failing feels like, because it does, you mentioned oxygen. I mean, it literally feels like someone switched the oxygen off.
Yeah.
And it's quite clear to everyone in the room that you thought that was funny and they didn't.
And they don't just disagree with you on it. They think you are a very substandard human being.
They're annoyed with you.
Yeah, they are angry.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how even when I was relatively new and, you know, you... from gig to gig, you had no sort of guarantee of how well it was going to go. It was amazing how the room felt like people seemed further away from you. It's the whole neurotic, neurons of your how you read a room and how well it. If things were going well, the room seemed really small and everybody seemed reachable and you could just reach out and touch everybody and everybody's in it together and we're all having so much fun. And the second you were dying, the room seemed four times as large and the audience were a mile away, all sort of like
But, you know...
They... Sometimes they were a mile away. They've gone so badly.
Come back!
Like someone had dropped a bad smell at the front of the room. They must move to the wall, everyone.
I've done that as well. Yeah. That's awkward. You have to blame it on someone in the front row.
No one assumes it's you. You're in charge. Yeah. You couldn't fart. He's in show business.
So we'll be running the Backyard Comedy Club experiential comedy nights.
Scratch and sniff.
Yeah, scratch and sniff. Where you can get your, what would it be, like offices, do you reckon we'd get in and then give them 5 minutes on stage each?
Well, I mean, there's already gong show nights, but they tend to attract people who've already started, even in the most basic way of being a stand-up. But I think there would be, you can imagine a Christmas show where maybe instead of booking three or four acts, let's not put anyone out of work. You've still got the same amount of acts, but you have a section where, you know, one member from each table.
Yeah.
Just to get they all come up and they do 2 minutes. Just it would give them a real appreciation of what we're doing up there and how potentially tricky it is.
Audience participation is often looked down on by myself, because I think, oh, I've written something that's quite clever and it's complex and I'm going to get up there and I'm going to do my thing.
Mm.
But I remember the old Funny Side of Covent Garden that was a beautiful club to do, and they used to make the compere do a thing that they set up a catchphrase for that evening.
Yes.
And there was a format to it. They had to, I don't know, they'd... What's, you know, it was a feed and a punchline type thing, like a nice to see you, see you nice.
Yeah.
But they had thrown out a noun and a verb or whatever to make that catchphrase for that night and that night alone. And I remember the first couple of times doing it, just hating doing it and feeling like some sort of cheap daytime television warm up for loose women.
Yeah.
And hating it. But then realizing how much it really brought the audience together for that.
Mm.
For that one moment, if nothing else, that and them feeling that they were at something that was live, that was different that night for them and them alone. And then it created a nice atmosphere for the acts to come in and do their well-honed...
You just reminded me, I used to do a little jolly... When I was the resident compere at Screaming Blue Murder in Wimbledon Village back in the late 90s, I used to get the audience to sing a song with me for that very purpose of let's make us a thing. I could do it for you. You have to repeat after me like the audience did.
So, yeah, both.
So here we go. It went like this. So you repeat after each line. It's Friday night.
It's Friday night.
And we are here.
And we are here.
For a little bit of a laugh.
For a little bit of a laugh.
And a couple of beers.
And a couple of beers.
We love you, Ben.
We love you, Ben.
You're our best mate.
You're our best mate.
Let's not beat around the bush.
Let's not beat around the bush.
You're fucking great.
You're fucking great.
Hooray! Let's all get applause.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
that's good.
What we did at the Screaming Blue Murder at the Dobbin Fox in London Village. Because that was my first residency, and Pete Harris, from legendary promoter from Screaming Blue Murder, he was the one who told me to give up my day job. And it was such a fantastic and exciting thing for someone who appeared to be a proper grown up businessman telling me something so counterintuitive at the time. And, you know, my parents were like, don't give up your day job. And he was like, give up your day job. You know, you need to, and then you'll take this more seriously and it'll happen. And he gave me this one regular Friday night every week gig. Didn't pay much, but it was the beginning of feeling like a professional comic.
Yeah.
Because he was annoyed every time I turned up tired because I had
done
40 hours of work a week. You know, I'd turn up on a Friday. And he'd be like, you're too tired to do this. You've got to stop work. You've got to give up job. And I was like, give up my job?
Yeah.
And then I did.
Amazing. And the Jeopardy, weirdly, it helps you push the thing you do.
It makes it absolutely for real that you're going to try and make a living out of this precarious thing. You know? But luckily, at that time, things were booming. You know, jonglers were opening up more gigs and there were clubs in every town. And, you know... We lived through great days.
Yeah.
They'll come back again. I mean, there's still great clubs out there and there's still great comedy going on. The quality that I see on Thursday nights at the new act seems better and better. You know, the standard of the sort of the average act seems to be getting better all the time. It's just, I think, the structure of the sort of network of clubs throughout the country is in a state of flux that hopefully will...
Some promoters are coming in, aren't they, and taking over some of the Jongleurs venues and some of the buildings and hoping that they can find those punters to come back. And some of them will come back if they realise it's a higher quality product and that they won't be surrounded by...
The people on the office parties that don't want to be there.
Because, you know, there obviously is a place for office parties and well-behaved hens and stags at comedy, and I've seen lots of them be surprisingly nice, you know.
Yeah.
There's, you know, the old Reading Jongleurs, which has been... Is it...
Comedy Loft.
Comedy Loft. You know, that's so genteel these days and pleasant to play.
I've been there for a while.
Yeah, it's a nice gig.
We had a Hindu on the boat show a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't even realise they were in. And I was comparing.
Yeah, no laughs?
No, they behaved like a proper audience rather than as a Hindu. I think. And it was only when sort of like leaving the backstage area and they'd turned what was the club into the disco that I started to see people with sashes and silly outfits. But they had been at the back of the room and they behaved themselves. Yeah. Unheard of.
But you know what? I think people aren't drinking as much as they used to. People used to drink so much that they were broken by the time the gig started. I think people are a bit, they haven't got the money, and the culture's slightly shifted away from heavy, heavy boozing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should open a comedy coffee shop for that culture.
That'd be studious, wouldn't it?
And 24-hour gym.
A good joke, good joke. Another flat white, please.
No tapping, just flicking.
Yeah, so I'm laughing at the jokes you're not telling.
But no one will want to, you know, outshine you or, you know, say anything out loud because they feel they're the funniest, because they lack the confidence in reality, so it was fine.
Low self-esteem audiences, that's what we want.
Yeah. If everybody out there could lower their self-esteem and then come to these nights.
Maybe that is the catchphrase I'll start using. Lower your self-esteem!
David Whitney, as you come on the stage.
Lower your expectations with that esteem. And when you feel that rock bottom, David Whitney!
I can do your intro tonight.
Thank you.
I've introed Harry Hill, so I'm pretty sure I can do that for you.
Seasoned
professional.
So what's next? What's coming up? Anything you're working on at the moment? You got those songs that you...
I'm going to record an album of those songs.
Oh, wonderful. Something wonderfully creepy about them, as well as being funny, that I can imagine they need...
Yeah, well, funnily enough, so many of them have ended up with a slightly dark, slightly sinister sort of... There's another one about skeletons in my closet. It's not me, it's somebody else, but somebody who says they haven't got any skeletons in their closet and then reveals bit by bit that they do indeed have quite a few skeletons in their closet. So, by accident, they became little short kind of tales of the unexpected dark with a slightly amusing side.
And you're recording that to release it on...
Find some format that, because people don't buy CDs anymore, do they? No. But I believe that some people are selling stuff like
USBs.
That with on a USB type thing. Yeah. So that's the plan, but mostly just to get them documented and it'd be quite fun to do, I think.
Mm. Have them out there.
Yeah. Other than that,
news for that will be found on your website, Ben Norris.
www.bennorris.co.uk. News of that will be on there as soon as I can put it on there. I'm on Twitter as well, Benny_Norris. So it might appear on that.
Thank you so much for coming on, Ben.
Hey, man, enjoyed it.
Lovely to have you here. And hopefully you are parcel crossing the big wilderness of comedy.
This is that weird bit where we finish speaking now and then it's like something unnatural has happened because we we've got to talk like we're just in a room together. We are in a room together.
Oh, no, we just stop talking to people afterwards.
Just blank
a ghost.
Yeah. What an arsehole.
We're still here.
Okay. I've got no skeletons in my closet. Well, actually, there's one. My neighbour's Jack Russell, it bit me. So I choked it with my thumbs. I've got no skeletons in my closet. I tell a lie, there's two. My neighbour came to find his doggy. So I choked that bastard too. I've got no skeletons in my closet. All right then, there's three. A politician came a knocking. Now he's no longer my MP. I've got no skeletons in my closet. All right then, there's four. Someone outbid me on eBay, and they were never seen no more. I've got no skeletons in my closet. No, there's one, two, three, four, five. She unfriended me on Facebook. Now she's no longer alive. I've got no skeletons in my closet. The stench made neighbours sick. One came around complaining. Skeleton number six. I've got no skeletons in my closet. Actually, there's seven. I really cleaned the window cleaner by sending him to heaven. I've got no skeletons in my closet. A policeman came to investigate. Well, of course I showed him to my closet. He's skeleton number eight. I've got no skeletons in my closet. Well, now you know that's just a lie. My peripatetic piano teacher, she's skeleton number nine. I've got no skeletons in my closet, and I won't say this again. I drank a very special potion. Now I'm skeleton number 10.
While they sniff each other's butts, while they lick each other's nuts.